Blog Talk Radio.
Project.
Okay.
In 1973, the Assyrian Society was created, as you know. And Ron Nefron, the first, designed the society, created the society, to provide a vehicle for those of us in the diaspora to not just study about African culture, ancient African culture, but to apply those principles and values into our daily lives. And to that end, Assyriset has always been about the process of seeking out truth and knowledge wherever it is, if it's a value, and incorporating it as we can into our protocols and procedures, as long as it doesn't violate the basic principles and foundation upon which society rests, which are the teachings of ancient Canada, so-called ancient Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1982, the Paramount Chief, they call him Paramount Chief, we refer to him as Paramount King, mm-hmm. of the Agogo traditional area of Ghana, Nanokoko Thorpong, came to the U.S. with the express purpose of interacting with, meeting with leaders in the African American community, specifically those interested and engaged in African culture in the African American community, to try to form a liaison between the Asante people in Ghana, which is where the Asante people live, and those of us here in the diaspora. And his mission was to create this liaison for, as a prerequisite or a foundation or an advanced man, if you will, the coming of his king, the Otumfo Pokowai II, who was coming to the U.S. in 1984 as a part of the Asante exhibit of gold, which was being promoted by the art institutes here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Now, what has been the case to that point, and still largely the case at this point, whenever people like this come from the continent, they often do not have access or not given access to the African-American community, and vice versa. We're not given access to them. They're shepherded through, the official channels. They're taken to the hotels. They're taken to the dinners, the state dinners, the thousand-plate dinners, whatever. Mm-hmm. And they never have an opportunity to commune with those of us in the community here. So this was what the Nanokoko visit was about, is to not just create this connection, but to provide a vehicle for the king, when he came, to be received by the African-American community and to be engaged with the African-American community. So one of the people that Nanokoko met was Shechem Shechem.
Mm-hmm.
And he traveled. We took him. He met the community in New York. We took him to Philadelphia, here in D.C. He also went to the Atlanta community. And he saw that Assyriset was committed to the principles upon which we were founded. That was incorporating and developing African culture as a foundation around which we organized our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, he asked the Shechem Shechem to host a Durba for the Asante Henny when he came in 1984, which we did. The Durba was held in New York at City College on the grounds, the athletic field of City College. It was overwhelming success in terms of the presentation, and so as a result of that interaction, then the king came to Washington. We also met him here. And as a result of those engagements, he, the king, Otumfo Pokowai II, invited the Assyriset Society to come to Ghana in 1985 to celebrate with them the 50th anniversary of the restoration of the Asante Confederacy.
Okay.
And we'll get more into this story later on in coming weeks as we go through this process.
Okay.
But essentially, it's also as a result of the last war fought between the Asante and the British which was the Yasanto War. Most people are familiar with that war. When the Queen Mother of Ijesu led the Asante people in a battle to preserve the golden stool that the British wanted to claim as their own trophy, and the Asante people refused to give it up, the Queen Mother of Ijesu rallied the forces and they fought the last wage battle with the British. The Asante lost the military conflict, but they didn't lose the war because the objective of the war was the golden stool, and the Asante never gave it up. They preserved it, they protected it, and the British never got it. As a matter of fact, the British got a fake one, and they didn't realize it was fake until they got all the way back to Britain. But that's another story. So at any rate, as a result of that, though, the British did colonize Asante and bust up the Confederacy. And it was in 1935 that the Confederacy was reestablished. And they were celebrating the 50th anniversary in 1985, and that's the event which we invited to attend. So we went to Ghana in 85. It was the first trip as a society to a continent. There were individuals who were on the trip who had been to Africa before, but not as a member of our delegation. There were 55 of us who went on that trip.
Wow.
And it was my first trip to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And it couldn't have been a more powerful emotional experience to have for anyone. To see the pageantry and the majesty of the Asante nation, the royalty of the Asante nation, as it sat in state, as it performed throughout that period of the Golden Jubilee, is indescribable, really. You really cannot put in words. There's no way I can convey to you what was taking place. Suffice it to say, it was majesty at its best. It was pomp and circumstance at its best. It was everything we imagined about African glory was manifest that day through the Asante nation itself. And I was very touched by it. I'm sure we all were. So we spent the time there at the Golden Jubilee, which was the big Durba, which was all of the Asante kings. Again, they refer to them as chiefs. They refer to the Asante Hene, who's the king of all the Asante, as the only king, and everybody else is a chief, paramount chief, etc.
Okay.
But all of them, 30-some of them, were resident at that Durba with all their delegations. You know, you have 30-some different rhythms being played simultaneously, people moving through this huge stadium, thousands of people moving through all the different, the phrase that everyone moves to his own drummer was was truly impactful for that day, because all these communities had their own rhythm section, their own drummers, and they were all parading through this parade ground to their own beat. But all, even though there were different sounds, it was all in unison. It was truly stupendous. So as a result
that had to be something for you, for your first trip to Africa, to see that. I mean, you mentioned that there were people in the delegation, in your delegation, that had been there before. But for you, being the very first time if you had gone and not been a part of a delegation, just that first time, I'm sure it would have been memorable in and of itself, because it was, of course, your first time going back home, for lack of a better term. But to have this great big celebration going on at the same time with it being your first trip home, that had to add to the wonder and splendor of the whole event for you emotionally.
Oh, true. Without a doubt. And so we then participated in Kumasi. And then we also were invited to, well, while we were in Kumasi, I should say, the Otunfo Asante Hene presented Chekumashekum with a stool. That's how they confer kingship through the Asante system. They use they present stools.
Mm-hmm.
And so Chekumashekum receives a stool, therefore making him a king, recognized as a king within the Asante, which eventually led to his being recognized as a king throughout Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
As well as when we went to Agogo, the paramountcy under the Agogo Indian Manacoco Stapon. He was presented with another king, another stool, sorry. He was also made co-ruler of that area. And we were all made citizens of Agogo. It was a little ceremony where we were all proclaimed citizens of Agogo. We all paid our little taxes, and we became a part of that community. So this was, you know, all this was whirlwind within like a week or 10 days or so. It was truly a phenomenal experience. Then we did the, you know, we went through the castles where the Africans were held before they were shipped overseas, et cetera. So we did that thing too, but there's nothing that can compare to sitting in a state event when the Asante Nation is all present and represented, and the king is there in all his glory. It was a magnificent event and occasion, and it was through that event, through that experience, that the idea of doing this work first came to me. I had finished my master's in 75, and, you know, because of life, with children, wife, et cetera, job, et cetera, I wasn't able to go on. I always wanted to go on and do a PhD, but I wasn't able to do it because, you know, life happens.
Right.
And so the idea came while I was there I wanted to do a PhD, but the initial thought was going to be on the kingship in the developing African state. I was looking at, and Ghana has a unique system in that through the establishment of the Republic and of Ghana, there were certain traditional norms that were preserved as a part of the constitutional government that was created.
Okay.
You have the government, for lack of a better word, the Western government, style government, with the president and the ministers and the representatives, you know, the analogous to our House of Representatives and senators, the MPs, they call them, similar to the British, because the British had colonized Ghana, so they kind of adopted a model similar to the British model. So you have members of parliament, et cetera. But they also, in their insight and foresight, instituted as a part of the governing state the institution of chieftaincy, meaning that chieftaincy is a part of the constitution of Ghana. So they didn't just come in and superimpose the Western model on everybody and throw out the old. They preserved the institution of chieftaincy, which is the traditional way the African people have ruled themselves for thousands of years, dating back to ancient Canada, the earliest recorded instances.
Okay.
And in addition to that, not only do they preserve it, but they have a parallel system. So where you have the National House of Representatives, or the MPs, et cetera, you then have the National House of Chiefs, which are headed by the kings or from different areas. So they have elected, they have a regional House of Chiefs, so the chiefs in the central region of Ghana, for example, form the regional House of Chiefs, and those in the Volta region have a regional House of Chiefs, those in the Asante region have a regional House of Chiefs, those in the northern region have a regional House of Chiefs, et cetera. And then there's delegations from the regional House of Chiefs, which then formulate the National House of Chiefs. And it's through the National House of Chiefs that the institution of chieftaincy itself is promoted and preserved throughout the government and the Constitution. Now, historically, because the chieftaincy system has been from all the peoples in Ghana, basically, has been the political system that through which the people have guided their lives. When the Western system came in, people also held on to the chieftaincy system in such ways that, in many cases, the chief in an area people who are elected by the in the traditional system, voters, et cetera, the MPs, et cetera, all communicate and work with and through, in many cases, the chiefs in this area, because the people's, many of the people's allegiances are more closely tied with that of the traditional system than with the Western system that's been superimposed. Even though there's been a degradation of those relationships through the years, back in 82, it was very strong.
Mm-hmm.
So that the members of the district assemblies, et cetera, they all, if they wanted to do something in the area, in Agogo, for example, they had to communicate and get the approval of the Agogo Henny before that they were allowed to pursue it. So Ghana is unique in that case. So Ghana went an extra mile to preserve the traditional system. So that was my initial thought. I'm going to do this thing on developing kingship and developing African states. And I was looking at, do like a model, use Mao Zedong as a profile for what and how this process was working. Well, over the years, that was in 85, when I first got that idea. And then 86, we went back again. And as a result of the work that we've been doing here in Sarasota, I was promoted to a king, permanent king within the Sarasota system. So this added more impetus for me to really look at kingship systems historically and contemporarily as how we can use this, or is it valid for us to consider using it as a means of organizing our lives as African people.
Mm-hmm.
And so over the next 15, 20 years or so, I looked at it several times. I looked at different schools here in the States to do the work at. But I wasn't able to do it because, circumstances, time, and economics is a large piece. It's a very expensive proposition, and time and children and all the things that go along with life here in the States.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 2007, I did a DNA test, and I found out that my father's people came from Ghana, not from an area that I had been to, but from an area in the Volta region called Nkonya that I had never visited. That was 2006. 2007, we took a trip over for the 50th anniversary of the institution of the Ghanaian state. Ghana was independent in 1957.
Mm-hmm.
In 2007, they marked their 50th anniversary. So we went over to participate in that. As a result of that trip, I Mao Zedong arranged for me to go to Nkonya to visit for the first time to visit this community that was my paternal ancestral lineage.
Mm-hmm.
As a part of this trip, I was in school there in Nkonya, and I also then had met a chief from the north in Kumasi. He lived in Kumasi, but from the north, who was related to a girl that I had adopted in Agogo in 1986 or 87. I adopted a young girl in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
That I met in Agogo, and I helped her through school, through, the 80s and 90s. And in 2000, we were able to bring her to the U.S. to do her education here. But I met a relative of hers in 2007 who worked at the university in Kumasi, Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology. And I invited him here. We had an event here that he participated in. He came over, and we were just talking. And I just mentioned one day that I wanted to do I had thought about doing a PhD in African culture. And he said, there's a program at the university that I work at, which is an external program that you should look at. So I did, and I was able to get enrolled in the program, and it was there that I began to formulate the project that we're currently talking about, which was the Asante model, Asante kingship, the Asante divine kingship, I should say, as a model for sustainable development of self and community. And the Asante model, back to your earlier question, why the Asante model, is because, like many other peoples in Western Africa and other parts of Africa, the Asante trace their historical line back to the northeastern part of Africa, where Kemet was. And when you study the Kemetic system and you look at the Asante system, you find parallels between the two. As a matter of fact, one of the researchers that I looked at as a part of this project had written a book called The Divine Kingship of Ghana and Ancient Egypt. And in this book, the person, Mary, which is her name, she goes through and she traces the Asante lineage back to northeastern Africa and shows how many of the symbols in the Asante system came straight out of ancient Egypt, came out of ancient Kemet. And so they have their oral history where they came. There's research out there that shows that there's a linkage. And through our interaction and engagement with them, we've seen, you know, connections and relationships. So the decision to make this the focus of the thesis was predicated on all of those factors, as well as the fact initially what I wanted to do was I was going to title it the kingship, divine kingship of Asante and ancient Kemet as a model, etc. But because of my advisor suggested that I just focus on Asante, and then I can weave in the linkages and the discussions about Kemet, because he wasn't adequately prepared or skilled in ancient Kemetic history and culture. So he wouldn't be able to, quote unquote, advise me in the process. But he said that we focus on the Asante, and then you just make the connection, show the linkages as you go through the process, which is what we did in this project. So,
Brother Orwa, the lines are lit up. And again, today's show, Brother Orwa is just giving us an overview of the discussions to come. We're going to be talking about the Asante model. Again, looking at that, we're going to be discussing different aspects of that model. We're going to be looking at the political, the environmental, the economic, the social, the kingship. I mean, it's getting ready to get really in-depth. And so I want to let everybody know that we're going to be doing this, having this discussion for the next several Wednesdays. Okay, so make sure you mark your calendar. So for the next several Wednesdays, we're going to be covering the different aspects of this model. And again, I want to thank Orba for being my special guest today. Brother, you mentioned the chieftaincy and how when the West came in and colonized the country, they adopted a Western model in some regards, but they did maintain the chieftaincy aspect of their tradition. Speaking of the chieftaincy, how is that conferred? Is that I assume that they don't take a vote on that. I don't want to assume, but I assume that they don't vote on it necessarily. Is it passed down from a particular person's lineage, the father or the mother? How is that a person's chieftaincy conferred upon them?
Okay, that's a good question. Let's first look at the African system versus vis-a-vis the Western model, for example. Everybody's familiar with the British model of kingship, right? The divine king in Africa is looked upon as a representative of the supreme being to the people that he is there to guide and work with.
Okay.
And which is different from there's a concept called the divine right of kings, and then there's a concept called the divine kingship,
mm-hmm.
which are two different things. The divine right of kings is the kind of system that the British, for example, and other Western countries have employed. And the basic theme is that the king is there as a result of a relationship with the supreme being, God, and therefore he rules on behalf of the supreme being, and only answers to the supreme being. So there's no human, quote unquote, or personal engagement or authority that the people themselves have. This is something between the king and God, and whoever God, quote unquote, appoints or anoints or whatever system is in place, that is completely beyond, quote unquote, human intervention or human engagement, which is different from the divine kingship. And this is another reason why the Asante model is so valuable, because the Asante model is strictly in line with the traditions of ancient Kemet, in that Asante model is based on a matrilineal process, as was ancient Kemet. Meaning, whoever was the king in ancient Kemet ruled because that person had a relationship with a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So the relationship with a woman, they either married a woman, or they were from their great-grandmother was the queen mother. There was some relationship they had with a woman that gave them the authority to serve as the king. And so it's a clan or relationship, a familial relationship process. And the same is true in Asante. There are 12 or 8, you know, there's 8 maternal clans and 12 paternal clans in the Asante culture. But the maternal clans are the clans through which the rulership, the paramount kings or chiefs, and the king himself are extracted. And each community has a different, and they have a different of these clans as their ruling body. So, for example, the king himself of the Asante Confederacy comes from the Iyoka clan. Now, there will be Iyoka clan members throughout the Ghana, throughout Asante, which is about some 4 million people. And there's 32 different paramounts. So there will be Iyoka clan members in all of those areas throughout. So it will be thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people, perhaps. But the king himself comes from one of 3 families of royals, and who all share a common ancestress. So they all share a common ancestress, and as that woman, that queen mother of old, had children, daughters, that begin to expand out, then they then become the seed stock, quote unquote, for lack of a better word, through which the king is chosen. Now, it is a chosen process, in that the queen mother of the Asante is the person who has the right to nominate who the king will be. So no man can rule unless he comes through the woman.
Mm-hmm.
So the queen mother and the queen mother will choose between those members of the royal family, those males who are members of the royal family, who meet the criteria that is satisfied for leadership. And that is largely based on character development and social aptitude and political awareness and those kinds of things. We'll discuss more of that later.
Okay.
But the point is that she makes a selection from the available, those who have shown themselves through their growing maturation period that they are quality individuals who will meet the criteria for leadership, which is outlined in the Asante system.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, she will make a nomination. Now, the nomination then is presented to the Council of Elders, and they then have the ability to accept or reject her nomination. And so this the process goes back and forth. But so it is an elective function. It's a, when you talk about democracy, the African kingship system, as this demonstrated through Asante, is the most democratic of all, because the people who are chosen to lead are chosen based on their qualifications to lead, and they have to meet those qualifications or present those qualifications or be seen worthy of having that office based on their community themselves. So the people, it's not about popularity, it's not about money, it's about character, it's about training, it's about how this person was seen as a young child. They watch them from birth, and they measure their growth and development. And so, and there's certain guidelines and prohibitions and taboos that members of the royal family have to adhere to. This is, they're all watched by everyone in the community. So by the time the Queen Mother makes her announcement that she recommends that this person be the king, everyone, I mean, it depends on the size of the community, of course, will know this person. They've known him for years. They've watched them grow. They've watched them develop. They can tell if they've been a womanizer or a thief or any of those things, all of which will disqualify them in the eyes of the people. And so through their representatives, they will nullify that selection. So that's the process. And so it's very democratic. And not only is it democratic on the promotional side, but it's also democratic on the other end. I mean, if the king comes in, the person who's promoted as a king, and begins to function in a way which is in violation of the cultural values and traditions of the people themselves, he too can be removed from office. And it's a process for taking that person out of office. So the divine kingship in Africa is a very democratic process through which the people have the right to determine who was the king, but also who will preserve and maintain that kingship, and have the right to remove that person from kingship if they deem necessary. As opposed to, there's nothing you can do about Prince Charles. There's nothing you can do about Prince Edward or whoever the guys are. Those guys are there, and if they go out and murder someone and don't get arrested, whatever, you know, they still have their position in the royalty. But it's not the case in traditional Africa.
You know, that's interesting, because it's my question would be then, when you have situations where, let's say, the Western model and the traditional model cross paths, you know, for example, there could be something involving a particular area, let's say, you know, and the Western model, the people that have been put in place with the Western model, and I know that you mentioned that they have a healthy respect for the chiefs, the chieftains, and their own culture and tradition, but I'd like to know what happens when there is a conflict between the Western powers that be, quote unquote, and the traditional king or the chiefs of that particular region. You know, how would that be settled? Because I would imagine that, and it sounds to me like there's a very, very strong cultural tie in Africa with Africans and their tradition, but we do know also that there are people who have become, indoctrinated with other cultures that, or maybe the colonizing system, that they even frown upon their own tradition. I mean, there are times when I've met people, for example, I remember specifically meeting a person from Nigeria and was asking them about, you know, the Orishas and so forth. They were like, that's crazy. We don't do that anymore. That's old stuff. He was looking down even on his own spiritual tradition, and I would imagine that you have some Africans who have been indoctrinated and actually frown upon and look down upon the quote old ways. And my question would be, what happens when those old ways and the new ways cross, and there needs to be some sort of resolution?
Well, it'll be a case by case basis, and you're correct, largely speaking. Unfortunately, Ghana is unique in Africa. It was my, the exposure that I've had to most Africa. In most countries, the traditional forms of traditional forms have been pretty much, in some countries, completely almost obliterated. And,
mm-hmm.
and where they haven't been completely eliminated, the qualities and characteristics and the safeguards that were in place to ensure quality leadership have been corrupted. So
okay.
in many cases, you have people with titles who are reflections not of the essence of what the historical position meant, but more a reflection of the Western influence and the corruption that comes with that kind of influence.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll have political officials who are taking money under the table. You have the same factionalism that you have in political systems here. You know, you have people in different political parties who engage in violence against one another based on trying to win elections, et cetera. You know, the same kind of fight, which
mm-hmm.
is the best word to play it, that you see today here in the U.S. between the Republicans and the Democrats, and the idea that my way is the only way, and therefore if it's not my way, it's no way, that
mm-hmm.
can't exist in traditional Africa in the kingship system. King is put in place as the overseer of the entire community. There is no party, quote-unquote, interest that can be adhered to. Now, and so that's one of the qualifications that the person has to meet in terms of their position. And it's not going to be the same in all areas because, again, you will find people with titles who have fallen prey to the Western political influences, the corruption,
okay.
et cetera. But the thing that is, and which is again why the Asante model was so important, because largely the Asante do hold true to their cultural and heritage and their ancestral values. And when someone begins to act in those ways, kings do get destooled in Asante.
Mm-hmm.
Mothers do get destooled. I mean, people do get removed from office based on those kinds of infractions. So
mm-hmm.
it's not a perfect world. You know, you have the quote-unquote spiritual influences that you're speaking of. All of those are in play. But, you know, we'll discuss all of that, more of that, in weeks to come as
mm-hmm.
we look at the system. But just to foreshadow that or project that, you'll have that... the kingship itself is based on the spiritual teachings of the Asante culture. And the foundational teaching of that culture is that God gave the people a stool, a golden stool. And this stool that God gave the people became is a symbolic of proclamation that this is a divine institution, this divine situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that the stool is representative of the soul of the Asante nation. It's like the heart of the nation. I mentioned earlier how the British demanded it and the Asante refused to give it, and they
mm-hmm.
fought them and never gave it up. Well, that's the idea. It's like someone comes to you and says, "Give me your heart, or
mm-hmm.
I'm gonna kill you." Well, what are you gonna do? You're gonna fight, because without your heart, you're gonna die anyway. Well, that's the idea. That is within the Asante spirit, that they will do whatever it takes to preserve the golden stool, because it's a gift from God, and it's that which proclaims, it's God's proclamation of divinity to the system itself, and to
mm-hmm.
the culture and to the nation itself. And as a matter of fact, it was this act of the golden stool being brought from the heavens by one of the greatest traditional priest of all time, so Konfunoche, that created the Asante Confederacy that we're speaking of. Because up to that point, the Asante people were not a kingship. There was no Asante kingship. There were Asante kings, all of which were autonomous, who worked together or didn't work together based on whatever was going on within them in the situation at that time.
Okay.
Toward the 1600s, the late 1600s, there was a loose federation that the Asante sometimes would come together to fight a common foe, but then after the war was over, then they would go back to the autonomous system. Well, then, with the coming of the Golden Stool and the first Asante Henny, the Otunfo, Ose Tutu the First, was what created the Asante Confederacy. And all of the paramount kings who were there were some seven or eight paramount kings at that point there, they all swore allegiance to this one man who became the head of among equals. Because they were all, by their own right, equal in terms of their rulership. They all ruled their own communities autonomously. But they all decided to give up their quote-unquote autonomy and establish one of them as the sovereign so that they could have the strength to deal with the issues that they were confronted with, which were primarily they were all being colonized by another kingdom at that point. And when they came together, they decided to give up their so-called sovereignty, the autonomous sovereignty, to this one man and promoted him as the head among equals. Then that was what gave them the strength to overthrow the colonization of the other group that was the Dinchera, who had colonized the Asante. And then that led to the expansion of the Asante as a great empire. At its peak, the Asante Empire was larger than the current state of Ghana. So they grew quite. So it was one of the most powerful empires in Africa in this period of time. But this came about, and this is a great lesson that you and I and all of us need to look at, because ultimately, if unity is the key to our success as a people, and everyone says it is, people say, what's the problem in the black community? There's no unity. What's the problem in the black community? There's no unity. What's the problem in the black community? There's no unity. Well, what's unity? if unity just is the problem and there's no unity, what is unity? What does it take to unify, to become one with someone else? And the root of that word is unit, to become one unit. How is it that we can, throughout our different areas and communities, our different ideas, our different political persuasions, et cetera, unify in order to address our common issues here in the U.S. unless we are willing to give up our own individual, quote-unquote, sovereignty or autonomy and defer that to someone amongst us, a peer amongst us, and agree that this person will become the head or the spokesman or the focal point of our issue to press forward to resolve whatever the problem is we have in our community. If we're not willing to make that kind of commitment, then we're never going to have the unity. And so if history is of value, if we can look at it and extract the common principle that can be used and applied to the present, if we don't look back and see that the Asante were getting their butts kicked, all of them, individually, by this group, and then they decided that they were all going to give up some of their own autonomy, come together and rally and become one force. It's like the fingers on the hand. Everybody uses this as an analogy, right? You got a thumb, you got four fingers, and you open your hand. They each can do whatever they do, but when you pull them together, there's a much stronger force. But you have to decide that what happens if the little finger's got a mind of its own and says, I'm not coming in there with y'all. Then I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to participate in that. Because I want my personal proclivity or my personal desire is to do this or that. Well, you have to give up your person, a bit of your person, to the group consciousness if you want to progress as a group. You know, that's what it means to be a unit. Everything, everyone has a place, everyone has a role, everyone has a part to play, but there's a common focus, there's a common direction, there's a common idea, there's a common brain, if you will. You know, a centipede got 1,000 feet all moving in unison. So if you get 500 Negroes together, that's 1,000 feet, but we'd be going all over the place. Why? Because we don't have a common head. We don't have a common idea. We have a common thing that we agree that this is what we're going to unite around. This is going to become the central nervous system of our movement. This is what's going to guide us. This is the brain that's going to follow us, lead us, that's going to coordinate our efforts. It's got to be a coordinated event. And that's what the Asante were able to show and do. And because of that, they were able to preserve preserve and establish their traditions and culture. And to this day, some 400 years later, it's still strong and viable.
You know, brother, I think that for a lot of people, you know, what you just said, and it makes a lot of sense and it's on point, but I think that one of the issues for a lot of people when it comes to not being able to, for lack of a better term, surrender their egos, whatever they need to surrender to become a part of this this unified group, is the fear of becoming invisible. You know, it's like, okay, I think the thought is, okay, if I surrender myself, you know, or again, for lack of a better term, not saying that you have to give up your being you, but I think the thought is, why does that person got to be king? I want to be king, or if I'm not king, I at least want to be vice king or co-chief, a ruler or something. Make me ruler of an area or something. Can I get a corner or something? You know, because I think that people believe that with the council, for lack of a better term, of the people that are in the upper echelon of the hierarchy, that perks come along with that. And so I think that people feel like, okay, if I can't be king, if I got to give up something, can I at least be in a position of authority where people at least look up to me and, you know, and so I think that's part of it. Your thoughts on that?
Well, the key to success, which is what the Asante have shown, which is what happened in ancient Kemet, and which can happen for us today, is that it's just not about being king. It's about the divine kingship, which means that what we have to organize and rally around is God's pronouncement in terms of where and how we move forward.
Mm-hmm.
Just as the Asante have their ability to communicate with the spirit through their traditions, et cetera, until we can acknowledge and communicate with and in an objective way the spirit, the supreme being, that everyone can communicate and see, we're going to have these problems. There's not going to be any mass unification of African people if there's no mass spiritual understanding and promotion of African spirituality. The idea that you can operate as a strictly political sense as a ruler and leader is going to lead to the kinds of problems that we see now in the world. You know, the Western model has been superimposed all over the world, and wherever these superimpositions have taken place, there are problems.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because it's based on the ideas, the beliefs, the feelings, the emotions, the sensations of the people. People want to elect Donald Trump. Why? Because he says what the base race issue, he didn't say it straight out, but those who support him are supportive of the idea, yeah, we're going to take our country back, which means white man is going to be dominant again in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no appreciation or understanding or people talk about in God with trust, but people really don't have ability to truly understand what is God. And how do I know God? And what's my relationship with God? And this is why the African system is so important, because throughout ancient Canada, through which the foundation was laid, the understanding was that I am a divine being. I'm not a human being. And as a divine being, I have the same quality as the supreme being. And there's a process through which, though I may not be able to manifest or express the fullness of those potentials at this point in my development, there are processes that can be employed which will enable me to grow and awaken and become a divine being on earth. And throughout the Kemetic experience, we have documented evidence, hundreds of people, thousands of people, who were proclaimed by their peers to be, have become a divine being through their life, have become an Ophir, which was the term used to denote the man or woman who had become a divine being within the lifetime. And so it's a process that each of us, if each of us commits to awakening the divinity within us, then God becomes the leader, the brain, the central organizing force around which we move forward. So so those ideas of what I might personally want or feel like I need become secondary to my understanding that that's the person within me, that's the animal within me, that's the lower aspects of my being within me, that I have a higher part that I can aspire to, that I can awaken, that I can cultivate, and that's the part that's going to unify me with all of the world, with all of creation. That's the part which makes me one with God, which makes me one with all. So true unity can never be realized absent of a unification of the spirit of man with the spirit, his spirit, divine spirit, which are one and the same thing. Man and God share the same spirit. All we have to do is learn how to work that spirit, manipulate that spirit, so that it becomes the motor to express our divine consciousness in the world. So we have this consciousness, which is the understanding of what it means to be unified with all. And then we have a spirit, which gives us the ability to express that unity. And by wedding these two, then we're able to become candidates for true unity. Because we will never have it without that. Humans will never be able to unify. Animals will never be able to unify. You're not, in spite of what the stories you might have heard, you're not going to find lions and lambs laying down together. Lions are going to eat them. As simple as that. So it's the understanding that for us to overcome the limitations of the animal part of our brain, the limitations of the human part of our brain, to awaken and nourish the higher part of our brain, the prefrontal cortex through which our divinity can manifest, that's become the quest of each of our lives. And as we come together, each of us moving in that direction, then we can begin to create true unity, because it's not about what I personally might want to be or want to do. It's about what is best for the whole. And we have objective ways of communicating with the supreme being, the supreme knowledge, the supreme ancestor, in order to find out what is the goal, what's the direction, what is the pronouncement, what is the proclamation, what is the view that we need to adapt and develop, cultivate the processes to make that view a reality.
You know, I think that when we can start to view each other as family, you know, then that process will be so much easier. Because if you think of family, when you think of the sacrifices that parents make, and many of you out there listening are parents, and you think about the sacrifices that you've made for your children, that you may have foregone something that you may have wanted, you may have had a certain amount of money, And if you didn't have to buy clothes or buy food or pay, you know, the mortgage or the rent or whatever the case is, buy uniforms, whatever, school clothes or whatever, you would sacrifice what you may have wanted for that of the household. So, you know, to that end of becoming family and viewing each other as family, we do these shows. Brother Orwise, now in the midst, this is the beginning. You're so fortunate you actually caught the beginning of a brand new series that we're doing on the Asante model. This was an overview, okay, and what an awesome overview it was. He's set the foundation, laying the foundation for future shows to come. We'll be talking about different aspects of the Asante model. We'll be talking about the political aspect, the environmental aspect, the economic, the social. We touched upon the kingship today. And Brother Orwa, I want to thank you so much for being my special guest today, for agreeing to do this other series. And to all of the listeners, I want to say thank you. I've got a few announcements I'd like to make. First, I want to just state that there's going to be on December the 5th, that's a Saturday, if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, on December the 5th on Saturday from 1 to approximately 4, there's going to be the Divine This Time Health and Wellness Symposium. That's right. It's called the Divine This Time Health and Wellness Symposium, and that's going to be December the 5th at the Metropolitan Outreach Worship Center, and that's at 9300 Livingston Road in Fort Washington, Maryland. A few of my special guests are going to be at that symposium and presenting at that symposium. Brother Coy Dunstan, who's cured his mother of cancer in both breast, her liver, and her colon, he's going to be a principal speaker at that symposium. Also, Dr. Theodore Ted Watkins, who was just on last night, is going to be one of the speakers at that symposium, and as well as Frank Smith, who actually overcame liver cancer, will be presenting at the symposium as well. For more information, please call 301-248-2141. Again, that's 301-248-2141. Again, that's going to be on December the 5th. By the way, it's free. Okay, so again, if you are available, try to make it out to that. Also, I want to say again to all of the members of the Oseraset Society that have been on this show, thank you so much. Dua Nater, thank you. I mean, from Shechem and Shechem, Dr. Rahul Nefer, amen. We've got shows with him in the archives. I mean, so you can please scroll through, find the shows with him and listen to those shows. We did a show on his most recent book, Stress Free for Life. Of course, Brother Orwa Hehi Mitchell Ryan Comet, my special guest today, author of African Names, Unlocking the Keys, the Ancient Egyptian Keys to Your Power and Your Destiny. Get that book. I mean, if you've ever wanted an African name and you don't know how to go about the process of obtaining an African name, get that book. And also make sure that you tune in to this series we're starting now. It's going to be for the next several Wednesdays. Okay, so you want to mark your calendar. We're going to be talking about the Asante model for the next couple of Wednesdays. Yes, mark your calendar so that you can follow along and stay up with us on that. And spread the word. Again, I put this information out there. There are three different buttons on your Facebook. There's like, comment, and share. Please, all you have to do is click share. We're trying to spread this information because we're trying to change this world, okay? And we can do it, but we need you. And you can help by just sharing the information. Just share the link, okay? Certainly, I appreciate that. Also, I want to thank all of, again, some more guests. Hekshem Suharu, Shechem Meir Nater, he did a recent show with us not too long ago on the fall equinox. In that, he went around and discussed the different solstices, and, I mean, you can get a real education. Go back and listen to that show. That's with Hekshem Suharu, Shechem Meir Nater, talking about the fall equinox. I know we've got the winter solstice coming up, but go back and listen to that show because he gives an awesome breakdown of what an equinox is, what a solstice is, the difference between the two, and you can really help to get prepared for the winter solstice by going back and listening to that show. Shechem Tebraim Sa'ah recently did a show on five-element balancing Qigong. If you missed it, that's in the archives. Go back and check that out, as well as Sanupara. Keperong is a regular on, I call it now, Health, Wealth, and Divine. He comes on every third Tuesday of the month. He just did a show with us, and so you want to go back and check that show out as well. Brother, again, Shechem Tahuti Kamau, I've had him on before. He did a show on the Etefu conference. That was awesome. If you missed that show, go back and listen to that show as well. Although the Etefu conference has passed, that show is awesome, and you can get a lot of information just from listening to that show as well. Brother Orwa, I want to again say, my brother, thank you so much for your time, sir. Again, the information that you brought today is very, very powerful. I mean, when you were sharing in the beginning, I mean, you took me there. I could feel your emotions as you went home to Africa for the first time and was met with that awesome, awesome celebration. And you really laid a foundation for a powerful series coming up to really for us to look at the Asante model and to glean what we can from it. I mean, it was very enjoyable. I learned a lot today, and I thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us and my listeners. I really appreciate that, and I'm sure my listeners do as well.
Well, thank you so much for giving us the platform. And additionally, I would like to announce that and open up to your, any of your listeners, we're actually taking a group to Ghana for a similar celebration. It'll be a little less pageantry than that, but it'll still be very, very much in line with what I experienced. That the Nana Akoko's autonomy, Paramount King or Chief of Agogo Chisholm area, is celebrating its 40th anniversary on the school. And so we're taking a group over there for that celebration, as well as to visit the Songhai Center in Benin, which and someday we need to do a special show just on Songhai, and we'll maybe try to arrange to get the director the next time he comes to the U.S. to do a show with you.
Okay.
This place is phenomenal. And I tell everybody, if you're looking for solutions to the problems facing the world in terms of sustainable development, that's taking place right now in Africa, in Benin, it is a phenomenal place. So anyone who's interested, they can contact you, or they can contact, me.
Mm-hmm.
If they're interested in going on the trip, leaving December 25th, give yourself a good Christmas present or Kwanzaa present. Whichever year, Hanukkah, whatever you celebrate, and we'll be there for the new year. So you wake up on New Year's Day in the motherland. They can contact me at 202-497-2499 if they're interested in going. Take that.
You know, I just want to say thank you, my brother, again, because you've really laid out a compelling thought for us to really consider for those of us who've never been back to the motherland. I mean, you took us there today. You really, really took us there. And, I mean, I could feel the heat. I could feel the equatorial heat with you sharing what you did. So I'm very, very grateful. Also, I have another announcement just for those before you leave. My special guest on Friday, this Friday, is going to be Queen Afua. We're going to be talking about relationships. That's right. The title of the show is Fear and Desire. And my special guest, again, from 7 to 8 p.m. this Friday, is going to be Afua. So you don't want to miss that show as well. Dr. Ruby Lathan tomorrow, Thursday, and we're going to be talking about depression, what that is, you know, how you can overcome it, you know, what are the clinical reasons for depression, and maybe we can get into some spiritual reasons and other reasons as well, but how you can combat depression holistically, okay? So you don't want to miss that. So that's Dr. Ruby Lathan tomorrow from 7 to 8 talking about depression, and Queen Afua on Friday. We're going to be talking about fire and desire, how to maintain and cultivate sacred relationships. You don't want to miss that. My name is Jawanza. His name is Orwa Hehi, Metro Ryan Comet, Paramount King of the Aseraset region in Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Any final words, my brother?
No, I'll just say again, thank you for providing the forum to begin to express this.
It's my pleasure. My honor. I'm humbled to have you on, my brother. And so, you know, I bow to you, and I bow to the listeners, to Shechem and Shechem Ra'un Nefer Amen, to all of his teachers, his Shechems, his Orwads, his Orwats, and to all of those who are trying to be divine. Are you ready to be divine? Well, there's a way to do it. Keep tuning in to Health, Wealth, and Divine, and you'll be getting information on how you can make that happen. Okay, my name is Juwanza. Thank you so much for your time. Take care, everybody. I appreciate your time. Et puis.